Welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcasts. Now we are at part three of chapter six from Northern Heights, climbing America's highest peaks. Archangel, Mount Foraker, 1975. We've reached the lower part of the route. We've survived the killer storm. And now we are going to go for the upper mountain. Commitment. Back on the glacier, we salved our screwed-up biological clocks and prepared to sever the cord. We had lost precious days to Killer Storm, and now understood the size of the commitment we needed to make to the upper mountain. At 1 a.m. on July 3rd, Dave, Stu, Charlie, and Brad started back up to Igerview with another load, while Barb and I retreated to Glacier Meadow to retrieve some more food and fuel. Our commitment to the mountain was deeper, and we raided our walkout food to improve our chances on the Archangel. It was the first time that Barb and I had climbed together for several days, and we felt our old communion as we lingered on the tundra, watching the dawn sun slowly work its way down the Archangel. Pink and magenta suffused the surrealistic scene. As I contemplated my obsession, I felt very different from a week earlier. The Archangel was no longer a dream, hope, vision, or fantasy. I now knew that I was going up into the picture. We said goodbye to the tundra. As Barb and I walked back up the glacier with half of our walkout food, our bodies accepted total physical commitment. We now had intellectual, emotional, and physical commitment. Our commitment triangle was complete. On July 4, we vowed never to spend another night in sink camp and severed the cord. On July 4, 1963, had been my summit day on Denali. Now, 12 years later, I committed to Denali's queen. I started up the apron for the last time and did not look back. I focused my eyes up the queen. I did not know if or when any of us might stand on the summit, but I would not descend without an answer. Dave struggled up the target under a huge load. When I asked him what he carried, he quipped, 4 25-pound peanut butter sandwiches. When we arrived in Igerview, Dave dropped his load next to the igloo and said, "No more pancake tents." The first thing we did was eat the last of our homemade cookies. Then we repaired the sagging igloo and pitched the two frost-lined tents. It was a relief to be on the mountain, and we felt safer here than at sink camp. Early on July 5, everybody was tired, but there was no time for rest since the weather was perfect. Dave, Brad, and Stu went up to do the much-talked-about lead across the Angel's Way. This was Dave's big day. Charlie, Barb, and I dropped down to retrieve a last load from a cache above the apron. On the way back up, we collected anchors and fixed rope from the lower part of the route. We had a limited supply of both and would need the equipment higher. We brought commitment up with us. The Alaskan sun is intense in July, and changes on the Archangel's lower slopes amazed me. Several feet of snow had melted, and the ice underneath changed from hard Alaska blue to air-filled popcorn ice. An ice screw that I had placed on June 27 had melted completely out and hung uselessly on the rope against the ice that looked like a soggy piece of toast. Back in Igerview, we watched the others creep across the Angel's Way above us. Poised on the edge of Igerview, photographing their progress, I saw a huge piece of glacier 100 yards from camp silently break away. Igerview was not in danger, but I instinctively yelled, "Avalanche!" The crumbling serac slipped below camp with a near-silent swoosh. I cursed because I was not quick enough to photograph it. After several seconds, the air did not feel right. Then I felt it. A deep shudder rose from the mountain's bowels. For a terrifying tick, I thought, earthquake? Then I realized what it was. Filled with elemental fear, I sprinted out of camp and down the slope. The falling serac had triggered a huge avalanche below camp. The mountain's mantle shook like jello, and I wondered if it would shake our entire camp loose. From my precarious perch, I watched and listened to the Queen's anger as the seething destruction raced down at 200 miles per hour. Finally, the enormous epitaph roared to its final resting place on the glacier below. Slowly, a billowing cloud rose up to Eiger view and kissed us in warning. I didn't resolve anything, I just quivered. Dave, Brad, and Stu returned late in the day. They had successfully traversed the Angel's Way and located a wide spot in the ridge where we could place our next camp. Their mood was strangely sober after their great day. Dangerous soft snow had hampered their progress. The snow on both sides of the knife edge threatened to avalanche with each step as they balanced across. In the morning, the sun beat on the east side of the ridge, and the steps shone blue from underneath. Afternoon, the west side got the same treatment. Dave's effort leading the elegant ridge exhausted him. He discovered that being first on the Angel's Way was more hard work than glory. The upper mountain's nearness seduced Brad, and he spoke in excited technical terms. Stu also felt the upper mountain, but its power subdued him. Sitting on the edge of the Angel's Knife, he also felt his family's pull. The team's grip on commitment flickered as hazards tugged differently on each member. I desperately wanted the entire team to complete this climb safely and together. On the Queen, a tainted victory would not be a victory at all. In a somber meeting, we agreed that if we could not all go to the summit together, then no one would go. We were still low on the mountain, and I discovered that commitment was not enough. We still had to climb the mountain. We still had to ply our physical strength and skill. The Archangel jealously guarded the Queen's honor, and the Angel's Way was the key. Detachment. We struggled to get going early on July 6, another unbelievably clear day. Our large physical effort extended each day beyond 24 hours, and to compensate, we sacrificed sleep. We assumed that each clear day was going to be the last and climbed ourselves into a frenzy trying to keep up with the good weather. We packed modest loads and carried them up to the apex and across the Angel's Way. This knife edge was a bad place to burden ourselves with huge packs. With lighter loads, we felt secure and enjoyed the incredible voyage. We danced to an unseen conductor as we balanced across the ridge with our mind music playing. The graceful ridge led us gently upward through a vertical world. The Angel's Way was a rite of passage to the upper mountain. Beyond, we would belong to the Archangel. Our time spent on the Angel's Way was special. The upper end of the Angel's Way welcomed us with a wide spot where we cached our loads and lingered to absorb the beauty of this incredible place. I hugged Barb, and we agreed that these were life's remembered moments. On July 7, we moved our camp across the Angel's Way. As we ascended, so did the clouds. Not a storm. The gentle summer clouds just covered the tundra and milled around the lower peaks. As they rose, they filled the valley below and blocked the other world from our sight. They became the bottom of our new universe. The chimeric carpet climbing the mountain behind us urged us higher, and soon only the highest peaks remained. The carpet lingered at the apex, kissed the Angel's Way, but did not cross. With the exterior realm banished, our detachment was complete. Not just committed, we were with Archangel. We dug a deep-walled camp into the wide spot in the ridge at 10,000 feet and called it the Fortress. Near naked, we created fortress in the blazing afternoon heat and were strangely quiet except for an occasional song snippet. One by one, we stopped and listened to the mountain music. We saw the top of Denali over Crossan, and the sight inspired us. We had not seen Denali and Sultana together since Wonder Lake. The two great peaks were in command above the clouds. Tired and awestruck, we danced with greatness as we finished Fortress. On July 8, while retrieving our last loads from below, Charlie injured his arm with his crampon. Even after Dave administered excellent first aid, Charlie only had partial use of his right arm. The rest of the climb would test Charlie, but he was resolute. He was going to the summit. Our forward accelerating summit momentum absorbed the adversity. Archangel's upper difficulties would relent, and we hoped to move rapidly toward the summit still far above us. Dave and Barb stayed with Charlie in the fortress, while Brad, Stu, and I led up to high camp. Denali rose above a ridge like a scepter as we ascended the Archangel's steep spine. We overcame a long pitch of blue ice and reached our high camp site at 11,800 feet late in the afternoon. Stu was ecstatic because at last the snow was perfect for igloos. He said, "With a secure igloo here, we can leave the tents at the fortress." Denali, now clearly visible, shimmered and winked at us. Logically, we were close to launching a summit bid, but we knew that much hard work still lay ahead. We were having perfect weather, and it couldn't last much longer. As we descended, mackerel clouds led a band of cirrus toward us. Too tired to worry about the weather, we crept back into the fortress at midnight after a 19-hour day. July 9 was half over by the time we got going. The weather was still good, but the barometer dropped. We wanted enough food in high camp to allow us time to wade out any storm and still be able to go to the summit. Charlie remained in the fortress to give his arm time to heal, while the rest of us improved the route across the ice and carried loads to high camp, where we started our great igloo project. With Stu as chief architect, he planned a huge igloo 12 feet in diameter that would house all six of us. Denali was our guardian as we labored. Tired, we descended as the northern day slowly slipped away. Dream Climb's reality was hard work accompanied by fantastic vistas. Our efforts left us all tired and grumpy, and Charlie's arm still hurt. On July 10, our 26-hour days finally caught up with us. It was afternoon before we could even stir from our sleeping bags. The weather was still good, but the barometer continued to drop. We were in no condition to launch a potent summit bid and resisted the temptation to bolt for the summit. We decided to rest in the fortress for the remainder of the day and recycle for an early start the next day. We would go to high camp, finish the igloo, eat, sleep, and go to the summit on July 12. It was a reasonable plan that gave us much-needed rest, allowed Charlie's arm more time to heal, and cycled us back to an early start. We woke at 3 a.m. on July 11 and started climbing at 6. We left the tents behind and committed ourselves to the snow for shelter. As I cramponed up the ice, I wondered what we would do if the snow blew away. We got to high camp before 9. I looked at the partially completed igloo, then up at the clear summit 5,600 feet higher. I scanned the horizon and sniffed the air. The weather was still good. Should we drop our packs and bolt for the summit? It was tempting. I sniffed the air again as I considered our position. The upper part of the mountain was easier, but we were only halfway up the Queen. The barometer had dropped for several days in a row. We stood here without shelter and one injured team member. We had no acclimatization time above 10,000 feet. It was time to listen to my instincts. we finished the igloo. We worked on Stu's monster igloo for the rest of the day. It was a much tougher job than we anticipated. As cirrus clouds streaked the sky, Stu worked like a demon, sawing, carefully fitting the blocks and giving directions. Near the end, we doubted our ability to close the oversized structure. A closed igloo is a strong arch, but an unclosed igloo is not very stable. This was an all-or-nothing project, and we needed closure. With Stu's encouragement, we inched toward shelter under lowering skies. I was the tallest team member, so when we were ready, I carefully leaned against the structure that Barb and Stu supported from within to deliver a cone-shaped 4-foot cap block to 3 pairs of waiting hands on the inside. We had closure. Our finished igloo was a proud structure. It was 8 feet high, had a 12-foot interior diameter, and a long stair-stepped tunnel entrance on the downhill side. Our igloo would isolate us from the worst elements, and all 6 of us could live inside comfortably through any storm. A tired, silent crew parked on the padded porch eating dinner and contemplating the flaming evening sky between clouds below and clouds above. Tomorrow was summit day, but we just felt happy to have the igloo done. The barometer had dropped significantly since we arrived in igloo camp. After 12 days of perfect weather, Denali flew a bandera de combat. A storm was coming. Would it be another killer? Beyond detachment. A party atmosphere filled our igloo as we prepared for the night. Brad, Charlie, and Stu elected to sleep outside on the igloo's spacious porch. This was a practice that we had adopted in the good weather after Killer Storm. Stu especially liked to sleep outside. He did not need as much sleep as the rest of us, and many nights I found Stu outside, sitting up in his sleeping bag, scanning the night horizon and writing in his journal. Often the only sound that punctuated our slumber was the click of Stu's camera as he photographed the subtle splendor that accompanies the depths of Alaska's summer nights. In the igloo, Dave, Barb, and I talked excitedly about the summit, but I secretly hoped for a storm day to give us a chance to rest and acclimate to our new altitude. I wanted to climb to the top proud and erect, not dash up in extremis. We had worked hard to get here, and I liked being on Archangel. After 12 long years scheming for the Queen, I wanted to enjoy the summit climb. For every day spent on Archangel, there would be several thousand elsewhere. I had already spent many of those days wanting to be here and would spend many future days with memories of this transient time. I was in no hurry to run home. In the depths of the Alaskan night, Brad, Charlie, and Stu scurried into the igloo. It was socked in and snowing hard. The storm had arrived. We all squeezed together under a wall-to-wall down fluff and slept hard until noon. July 12 was our first storm day since the non-restful killer storm. This new storm was not violent, but it was not summit weather. We hunkered down in the igloo and enjoyed our first real rest day since leaving Colorado over a month earlier. In that month, we had walked 125 rough miles and gained 44,000 feet. The rest time was a balm for Charlie's arm. We ate, drank, talked, slept, talked, drank, and ate some more. Late in the day, Brad climbed into the igloo after a trip outside and pulled himself up on ice axes that we had placed for handholds in the igloo's entrance. A loud crack filled the space. I said, "What was that, your leg?" A stunned Brad said, "No, it was Barb's ice axe." He held out the broken axe for our inspection. Before the expedition, I had wrapped the shaft of Barb's sturdy wooden axe with fiberglass to give it extra strength, but it was not enough. Barb's shattered axe was beyond repair. Forward momentum was with us. In one of the most selfless moments that I have ever seen in the mountains, Brad immediately said, "Take my axe, Barb. I'll climb to the summit with the extra iced hammer." Barb protested, but Brad was insistent. He said, "I'm used to climbing with a short ice hammer. The summit slopes are not difficult, and I can still self-arrest with the hammer if I need to. We must balance the team's strengths." In a convincing display, Brad grabbed his axe, held it out to Barb, and said, "Take it." Our rest day passed too quickly. We crawled out of the igloo at 5 a.m. on July 13 to discover that we were between two cloud layers. It was not snowing, and we saw part of Denali in front of a gray-black eastern sky. The clouds forbade evil as we struggled with one of the most difficult decisions in mountaineering. Should we start for the summit? My instinct said no, but Brad quoted his father Dale's old adage, "If there is doubt, start and go until it's obvious that you should turn around." In 1963, my instinct said no on Denali's summit day, but Mike pushed us up, and we had the day of our lives. For me, Archangel and Denali were intimately linked. Perhaps this was the time to go for the Queen. We dressed for the strong wind and started toward the summit at 9 a.m. As I climbed, my body warmed to the exercise. My body said yes, but my mind said no. I wanted more than the summit. I wanted synthesis of body, mind, and spirit. As black clouds bore down on us, I knew that we could not have synthesis today. As I climbed, I mused that a fallacy with Dale Johnson's rule was that you could exhaust yourself in an unsuccessful effort and have nothing left to try again. After gaining 1,200 feet, the clouds closed, the wind increased, and driving snow pelted us. The weather absolved all adages. It was obvious that we should turn around. We zipped down to the igloo, feeling better from the exercise, and spent the rest of the day in glorious repose. Now we were poised for the summit, but in the night I wrestled with black thoughts as I watched the barometer drop to its lowest point of the expedition. We were safe in the igloo, but we could not stay poised forever. Archangel held us as we lay suspended through the night. Synthesis. I opened my eyes on July 14, immediately checked the barometer and muttered, "Damn, damn, triple damn, it's down some more. Probably another killer storm brewing." From outside the igloo, I just heard Brad shouting, "Hey, it's clear!" Astonished, I bellowed back, "Clear?" I tingled when he poked his head back in and said, "Clear!" We all rushed out and beheld a sparkling sky. Denali twinkled in the crisp air, and we watched small wind plumes fly off both Denali and Sultana. A sea of clouds below us lapped at Angel's Way. The low barometer was scary, but we could not argue with reality. We dressed for success, packed to climb, and started for the summit at 9 a.m. We climbed on two ropes of three, Stu, Barb, and I on one rope, Dave, Charlie, and Brad on the other. By prearrangement, Dave, Brad, Stu, and I would divide the 5,600 feet we had to climb into four roughly equal leads. Dave quickly crunched up yesterday's slope, and Brad climbed through into the lead as we started up steeper slopes. Exotic excitement filled the air, and we shouted encouragement to each other. Denali and the sun danced behind us. We climbed past the first rocks that we had touched since sink camp. We did not climb the rocks, just admired them as we climbed through the steep snow and rock playground. As I climbed in time to my mind music, I saw the rocks as Archangel's anchor. We stopped on the highest rock at noon and ate some lunch. Dave asked, "How high are we, boss?" I checked my altimeter and replied, 14.4. We're a little less than halfway. We still have 3,000 feet to go. Do you feel the altitude?" Dave said, "Yeah, a little." Barb said, "You need more fluid. Drink as much as you can." Dave eyed Denali and quipped, "Drinking this incredible view isn't enough, eh? Okay, pass the water bottle." His humor symbolized our team's family feeling. We left Archangel's highest rock and started up the Queen's vast upper slopes. This was Stu's lead, and he plowed through the snow like a man possessed. He and I understood that this transition to the heights was the crux. Archangel blended gently into the Queen's summit slopes, and with each step we were less a part of Archangel and more a part of the Queen's crown. Archangel pushed us toward the sky. Stu led far beyond his appointed time and distance. His lead was one of the most inspired that I had ever seen. He deftly dodged several extensive crevasses, and summit doubts faded with each step. He was relentless, resolute, and powerful as he reached for the sky. Stu's brilliant lead was a perfectly timed application of strength that pulled us from angel to crown. I shared his feelings of power. I had felt them when I waved Joff off and led toward Denali's summit ridge in 1963. Today, Denali watched another impassioned leader. Stu finally stopped on the crown's edge at 16,200 feet. As Stu, Barb, and I waited for Brad, Charlie, and Dave to catch up, the team achieved synthesis. For the first time in weeks, we had new views. Together, we gazed across 4 acres' small summit plateau at the 16,550-foot southwest summit. The traveling cloud carpet below occasionally dispersed and revealed peekaboo vistas to the north. We felt close to greatness and grace. With joy filling my heart, I started up Crown. My most wanted lead was not desperate or dangerous, it was a privilege. As I cramponed steadily up the hard snow into the sky, our synthesis symbolized all that we had worked for. This one day was ours, and we were the recipients of the Queen's grace. When I saw the highest point 100 yards away, I stopped to revel in the moment. Denali's Queen welcomed us to her crown, and we saluted her with ever higher arms. Gary Lucas should have been with us, and we had not forgotten. Gary's spirit was still with Barb and me. Memories of his spirit and life graced Crown when I released Gary's spirit and watched it fly free over the great summits. A swirling Peruvian ethos congregated from unseen corners swooped in tribute to all life, then spiraled into the sky. I was fortunate to be on yet another great summit with Barb. We all huddled together and congratulated Barb on being the first woman to climb 4 acre. The climb had been hard for Barb, and the Queen's crown had special meaning for her. I realized that my team's synthesis was due more to others' efforts than my own. I was just a vision-filled conductor. Our team's synthesis with the Queen was a gift. It was 7 p.m. We ignored the 6-degree temperature, 40-mile-per-hour wind, and 17,000-foot altitude as we ran around on the flat summit like children. We danced from edge to edge, trying to peer down other sides of the mountain, but Sultana's rounded summit cone prevented all but the most expansive views. To the northeast, Denali soared in his greatness. I looked at the west buttress, where 12 years earlier I first saw Archangel in the hand of God. Finally, I was able to return the gaze. To the east, I saw Mount Hunter for the first and only time on this expedition. Denali's child, Bagaya, looked just as spectacular from above as it did when Sheldon landed me on the Southeast Fork in 1963. I studied the Alaska Range's great peaks and realized anew that Denali, Sultana, and Bagaya formed a solid family triangle. Each family member had its own power, space, and grace. As I examined Bagaya looking for a route, I tingled with the thought that I should also climb Bagaya to further complete my union with this formidable family. I sensed, but could not yet comprehend, a vastly greater circle. However, in my four-acre euphoria, I had no idea that I really was looking at a future climb. I saw Stu on the southern edge of the summit, gazing south toward his family. Our ties spanned more than the Alaska Range, but we had both thousands of vertical feet and many unknown miles to transit before we slept. After 30 minutes on Dream Climb Summit, we descended into a gathering glow. I faced Denali as we steadily crunched down through deepening alpenglow, and for a harmonic half hour, Denali and his queen were the only two peaks in the hand of God. Again, I was in a supreme spectacle. I united the Great One and his queen with my gaze. As the sun dipped toward the horizon, I set mind music aside and listened to a deeper rhythm. For a delicate moment, Denali, Sultana, and I danced in syzygy. Then I became as Bhagaya, their protected child. I felt as if I was completing a life spiral, and my nascent life stood transfixed between my parents. Great Escape. The lights went out on July 15. Secure, we rested in the igloo as a serious storm raged outside. On July 16, there was 3 feet of new snow, and our worries about the descent deepened. With that much new snow, the avalanche hazard would be extreme on Archangel. We were running out of food and could not stay in the igloo much longer. We had to descend. Without a word, Stu went outside the igloo and hunkered in a hole for 3 hours, looking for anything he could spot in the whiteout. Finally, Stu crawled into the igloo and announced, "We're in a drift!" I replied, "Huh? What do you mean, drift? We're on a ridge." Stu persisted, "I mean drift. I've seen enough through occasional holes in the clouds to realize that there is not as much new snow lower down, and not as much at this elevation on other ridges. If we can just plow down for a few hundred yards, it will get better. Let's pack up and go for it." I had learned to trust Stu's instincts, so we said goodbye to the igloo and started down at 3 p.m. We soon discovered that Stu's astute observation was correct. It saved us unknown agony. Without Stu, we might have stayed in the igloo until the next storm. The snow and storm conditions were not as bad as feared, but the descent to Fortress was still difficult and dangerous, requiring all our concentration. We reached the Fortress at 7 p.m., where our once mighty 8-foot snow walls had melted to 3-foot humps. We had long worried about descending the Angel's Way. We had supper, and at 10:30 p.m., Dave, Brad, and I descended Angel's Way without packs to prepare the route. When we returned to the fortress at 1:30 a.m., Stu looked at the new steps, turned to me, and said, "Thanks." The single word spoke volumes. We began our final descent at 2 a.m. Our new steps were firm now, and the Angel's Way went well. But the slopes below were treacherous. Carefully, we descended through the night. When we reached Eigerview at 5:30 a.m., we ate breakfast and kept going. We rigged a rappel over the shockwave wall, then plowed a trench down the target. There were no anchors low on the route, so we rappelled one at a time for 400 feet down the bullet. Stu was the last to make the rappel, and when he didn't show up, we became worried. Just before we started back up to look for him, he appeared. All he said was, "I fell asleep at the top of the rappel waiting for my turn." We reached the remains of Sink Camp at noon on July 17. Remembering our vow to never spend another night in Sink Camp, we posed for pictures, loaded up huge packs, and staggered down to Glacier Meadow. After 29 hours of life-saving effort, We sank into lush green tundra with tears in our eyes. It had been 34 hours since we got up, but we were too tired to sleep well. We were alive, off the mountain, and dream climb was a reality. We spent July 18 recycling our psyche. Immense changes had occurred since we discovered Glacier Meadow on June 21. When we first camped here, we worried about avalanches whooshing down from Wolf Pass and burying our camp. Now there was no snow on those slopes, and we had to walk 400 yards to find running water. As rain pummeled us, we tried to focus on the fact that we still had to walk out. Since we had elected to use half our walkout food on Archangel, we only had 5 days of food left to extricate ourselves from the wilderness. We had to eliminate much gear to get our packs down to the 90-pound range for the walkout, and I agonized over what to throw out. I poked through my photographic gel filters trying to decide whether to eliminate the red or magenta filter. Stu came over, saw what I was doing, and said, "Jerry, you've got it all wrong. If you want to get your pack weight down, you have to throw out big, heavy things." Stu walked out onto the 4-acre glacier and, without ceremony, threw his wooden trail snowshoes into a deep crevasse. He came back to camp and said, "I loved those snowshoes, but I don't need them to walk out of here." Stu was right. We eliminated pancake tent, ropes, stoves, wands, and several other items, plus all my filters. With 4 days' food left, we started down the 4-acre glacier at noon on July 19. We were careful to avoid the now numerous rivers of no return. After 3 miles, we left the glacier, and I threw away my arrowed walk-in boots that I had worn to Denali's summit in 1963. I planned to hike out in my heavy double climbing boots that had served me since then on Lucania, Logan, Aconcagua, and 4-acre. I lost the better boots for walking across the tundra, both arrows and Denali Karma. As I clumped down grassy benches on the glacier's east side, I resolved to more carefully consider which big heavy things to throw out in the future. Visibility dropped to less than 100 feet as rain and dense fog enveloped us. Charlie was ahead of the team when he topped a rise and surprised a full-grown grizzly bear 30 feet away. Ignoring sage advice about not running, Charlie turned and ran back to us, yelling, "It's a bear! It's a heavy-duty bear!" We retreated in the fog and hunkered on the ridge for a while. I peered into the fog down the back side of the ridge, expecting the bear to circle and attack us from the rear. We never saw the bear again. We planned to shortcut through the foothills, and it was vital to keep track of our position in the fog. After several hours of map and compass work, we thought that we were at the bottom of our chosen shortcut valley. Before committing to the foothills, we camped on a plush meadow, hoping for better visibility. Stu, Barb, and I went on half rations to preserve options. The fog lifted during the evening, and we caressed the queen with our eyes for the last time. Stars appeared for the first time in the waning summer's night. Freezing rain greeted us on July 20, but seeing that we were in the right place, we started up our shortcut valley. Like Wolf Pass, we had no idea if the pass at the head of our chosen valley would work. As the rain intensified, we walked uphill through swirling fog with much trepidation. We found and crossed the critical 6,000-foot pass between unknown, unclimbed, and unseen peaks. We descended to the straightaway glacier, hoping to avoid a major river crossing. When the freezing rain persisted, Barb started shivering uncontrollably. We huddled around her under a tent fly and tried to eat lunch. When she could continue, we crossed the straightaway glacier, feeling smug about avoiding the straightaway river, then discovered a raging creek on the glacier's northeast side. We struggled across the icy wilderness torrent, lost even more body heat, and sprinted up the next hill trying to get warm. We climbed over a 5,700-foot ridge and descended into the Birch Creek drainage. By staying high, we had hoped to cross many small creeks instead of a few big ones, but discovered many big ones instead. Each creek was a rain-swollen torrent, and the miserable crossing slowed us down. There was much more water than on our approach. Late in the day, we reached Birch Creek's main fork and could not cross it at all. We camped, hoping that the water level would drop through the night. We were way behind schedule. Worse, we would have to cross the snouts of the Peters and Muldrow glaciers to avoid the Muddy and McKinley rivers. In 1967, Barb and I had crossed the Muldrow snout, escaping from the wilderness east of Denali. We tottered for hours across 5 miles of 300-foot-high moraine slag heaps. Then we still had to cross the Thoroughfare River to reach the Wonder Lake Road at the Eielson Visitor Center. We were not eager to repeat that wretched experience, but had no choice as we camped in the rain next to the uncrossable Birch Creek. Eielson was still 40 miles away. More freezing rain greeted us on July 21. Having no choice, we battled across a slightly lower Birch Creek, climbed over a 5,000-foot ridge, and descended into the Slippery Creek drainage. This was the drainage that Alfred Brooks had used to approach Denali in 1902. After all that we had endured, we were just now reaching an early explorer's high point, and that didn't help my mood. Trudging in the rain, I knew that we were up against it. My mind music was soggy, and Barb's had stopped. I had never seen her this tired. Was Archangel destined to end in desperation? I crested yet another ridge and had the answer. Unbelievably, I looked down and saw an airstrip. I blinked in disbelief. It must have been long abandoned, as aircraft landings were not allowed in Denali National Park. When I stared harder, I saw people moving in a vehicle. People! They were the first outsiders that we had seen since Burl left us in Caribou Valley over a month ago. I charged down the hill like the maniac that I had become, bashed blindly across a final wretched creek, and sprinted a mile to the vehicle. The people saw me coming from half a mile away. I ran up to them in a sensational froth, feeling like a savage running pell-mell out of the heart of Alaska's wilderness. After several minutes of confused conversation, we learned each other's stories. The people worked for a family-run antimony mine at Slippery Creek. They had an old mining claim and a special permit to work there. More important for us, they had a permit to fly there. They offered to fly us out, and we accepted. A few hours later, we blinked at cars passing by on the highway. It was over. Overtone. Our miracle flight out abruptly ended our intense wilderness adventure and saved us untraveled trials. Within hours, we rumbled south on the Alaska Railroad toward Anchorage. My swollen emotions surged in diverse directions as I reflected on our 37 days in the Alaskan wilderness. I had walked 157 miles and gained 56,000 feet while sculpting Dream Climb into life. Over twice my Denali effort. Never before had I felt so tired, alive, successful, powerful, and hungry. I had now climbed 8 of North America's 10 highest peaks, but the remaining 2, King Peak and St. Elias, were so hard that I was having trouble visualizing them. I was also lusting after other major peaks around the world, including Everest. However, Archangel had offered the 5th movement to my now Great Northern Mountain Symphony, and it was the best yet. The expedition's statistics were no match for reality. Dream Climb had drained us physically. I watched Barb slumped in her seat, which was a rare posture for her, and knew that she was beyond tired. However, her face was calm. Her mind was still on the summit. Gazing out the far window, I knew that she was busy crafting a lifelong and life-changing memory. For the moment, I left her to her meditation. Stu sat next to me, gazing out the opposite train window at the rush of passing trees. He vocalized his thoughts, which quickly gobbled me up. He spoke wildly about our adventure, and soon our babbling sprang to other impossible dreams. Our collective spirit bounded from one sensational summit to another without any regard for the physical effort required to get there. All things were not just possible, they were assumed. On the train, we could go anywhere our mind could fly, and I realized that we were riding the overtone of life. When the train slowed, then stopped in Talkeetna, I fell silent as my thoughts turned. I looked out at the ground, where in 1963, Joff, Mike, Dick, and I had jumped into the mud to meet Don Sheldon and start our Denali touch. I had indeed come full circle. I knew that Don had succumbed to cancer earlier in the year and was no longer here to greet climbers with a twinkle in Sheldonism. I felt that Sheldon was part of Archangel, and that his spirit was also with us on the summit. Without preamble, I let loose a spontaneous yowza. Barb and Stu looked up, but just smiled. They knew. As the train rumbled away from Talkeetna, I settled deeper into my seat and tried to rejoin the overtone. Exotic summits still framed a shimmering stage of possibility, but a touch of mortality stood between me and my summit skipping. I gently placed the overtone into memory, since in strength I knew that I could reach fantasy summits with effort. Yes, dream climb would provide an answer, and I was closer than I realized to the far greater circle. However, my imagination was not yet able to perceive that dream climb would be the bridge that would author my higher stage entrance, or that the greater circle would raise many new questions. Rocking with the train's gentle sway, fatigue finally found me. I dreamed.